Blog Talk Radio.
Warning. You are about to leave your comfort zone. Beyond the teachers. Beyond the gurus. Beyond duality. Ever beyond.
Good evening.
Talk Radio.
All right.
Beyond the teachers. Beyond the gurus.
I wonder if that's me being
beyond duality.
That is me hearing my own voice reflected back. Good evening and welcome once again to Blog Talk Radio and the Ever Beyond Show. Tonight, well, we have a pre-recorded show, mainly because this is rather late at night for many British people, and I'm speaking to a person in Britain for a change. Tonight I'll be talking with Barry Dunford, who has for many years been researching on the Holy Land. And you may think the Holy Land is somewhere in the Middle East. No, the Holy Land is here in Scotland, where I live. He has found caves, giants, evidence of Jesus, and many, many other remarkable ideas and discoveries. So, without any further ado, I'm going to play the tape. Now, if you wish to join me in the chat room, I will be there. And if you wish to join me just after the about 10 to midnight or in about 50 minutes time. If you want to hear the last part and want to enter into a discussion with us afterwards, I'm afraid Barry won't be here, but you'll be able to talk with other listeners and myself. So, without any further ado, here's Barry Dunford. And tonight we're talking with Barry Dunford, who is the author of two books. One is the Holy Land of Scotland, and that's subtitled Jesus in Scotland and the Gospel of the Grail. And his new book, which is called The Vision of Albion, subtitled Key to the Holy Grail, Jesus, Mary Magdalene, and the Christ Family in the Holy Land of Britain. So, Barry Dunford, welcome and good evening.
Good evening to you, Jeremy.
So it's very nice to speak to you. I remember many years ago when I lived in the south of England, in Glastonbury, I came across a small little book, a little pamphlet, and it was all about how Scotland was a holy land and that potentially Jesus had visited there and stayed there and the various other connections, including connections with huge caves, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right? Have you got the cave references in that book already?
I think that was in a later book when I wrote the two subsequent books. In fact, the Holy Land of Scotland book you referred to on our website, which has recently gone out of print, published in 2002, was a greatly expanded version of the little booklet that we produced in 1996. And in the 2002 book, and also a more recent one published at the end of 2008, Vision of Albion, I do touch into particular cave references, and I think several underground connections with cavernous openings in different parts of Scotland.
Okay, sorry, the phone is ringing here, so I'm just trying to fade myself up. And in terms of the original pamphlet, and the subsequent work that you did on it, what can you tell our audience about the magic and the magnificence of Scotland's holy history?
Well, this really became apparent to me after my wife and I moved into central Scotland 20 years ago, back in 1990. And I really needed to be in this area, which is called Highland Perthshire, right in the centre of Scotland, to understand, I think, some of the ramifications of this story connecting to this area.
Mm.
And it was through coming across certain historical curiosities and anomalies that really sort of attracted my interest and attention to do some research. And for some 15 years now, I've been researching into what I see as possibly the hidden history of the British Isles in general, but Scotland in particular. And as a result of that, I produced these written research works. And one of the things that I think first triggered my attention was this curious tradition, an oral tradition, that Pontius Pilate was born at Fortingall, right here in the centre of Scotland. And I think there's a few people wondered about this. I mean, there's nowhere else in Britain that has any kind of association with Pontius Pilate, so why would this obscure hamlet in central Scotland have what appears to be an oral tradition linking Pilate to this particular area? So, you know, later played, you know, sort of a crucial role at the crucifixion of Christ.
That's something that certainly raised my eyebrow when I read the book.
Yeah, sure. So this was something that, you know, caught my interest, and I started to look into that and to other ramifications that sort of developed from that, the Roman connection here, the fact that the old Scots kings had their royal seat at Fortingall, and part of the oral tradition was that Pilate was actually related to that old royal Scots lineage, and therefore had possibly Celtic ancestry. And subsequently, I found other information to suggest that there could be some truth to that. This is further research I put into my books.
Wow.
Fortingall itself, as I say, is pretty much right at the centre, or the heart of Scotland, geographically right at the centre. Mm. One of the Gaelic names of Fortingall, Fiatmingal, translates as the stronghold of the strangers. So I was thinking, well, who were the strangers? Well, Galloway, down in southwest Scotland, is translated as the land of the strangers, so the land of the Gael. So presumably the Gael, the Celtic Gael, were seen for some reason or other as strangers. And also later on, the early Celtic Culdee monks, the Culdees, from the Gaelic Culdee, which has been translated as certain strangers. Who were these Culdee monks, these strangers? Was Fortingall a stronghold of this early Celtic Culdee monastic tradition that followed apparently the mystery teaching of St. John? So there were all kinds of elements started to feed into this. And of course, I knew about the familiar stories and legends about Jesus and Joseph of Arimathea being associated with southwest Britain, mm-hmm. particularly Cornwall and Somerset, Glastonbury, for example. And I looked into that, and I could see that there were certainly indications that this up was having some sort of credibility, particularly place names. One of the few things that survived, if virtually the only thing that's contemporary that survived from that period, say 2 millennia ago, are the old Gaelic place names.
Mm.
You know, the records have either been destroyed, lost, covered up, or whatever. But the Gaelic place names have pretty much stayed the same. And when you look into that, you can sometimes find clues as to what might have been happening at that particular period in time.
Mm. So where do you think that that this period of time started? When you say the ancient Gaelic name, how old are we talking? I mean, if you say that Pontius Pilate's from Fortingall, then does this stretch back way beyond 2,000 years ago?
I think probably the roots of it do. I'm not sure of the exact chronology, because when you're dealing with these ancient periods, it's very difficult to be hard and fast for sure about anything. Mm. Even a lot of modern archaeology and so forth, to some extent based on guesswork, assumptions and presumptions, which may or may not prove to be correct. The problem is having access to contemporaneous information that really verifies what was going on.
Yes.
And what I've noticed is that there's a dearth of information, particularly around the 1st and 2nd century AD, relating to the origins of what we call Christianity.
Mm.
Now, from the 3rd century onwards, when we have what I call Constantinian churchianity, there's literary records extant, there's archaeological remains. We've also got archaeological remains and literary remains from, say, the Roman historians from the BC period, like the 1st, 2nd century BC.
Mm.
But there seems to be an interesting, almost significant gap for that crucial first 2 centuries.
A gap in the data. Now, Do you, I and probably most of my audience would say, well, they obviously got rid of a lot then. But
yeah,
do you think it's a deliberate policy?
Yeah, it looks to me as if someone didn't want people subsequently to know what was going on in those two crucial first centuries AD, which really saw the origins and the original development of the teaching of Christ, as opposed to the later sort of stuff that came through to, as I said earlier, the time of Constantine, when they were whiffing out all kinds of material from the Council of Nicaea and so forth. And subsequently, of course, we now have what we call the apocryphal texts, which gives a lot of information about the Gnostic.
Always much more interesting.
going on there. It's almost, I mean, why were they taking all that stuff out of circulation in the 3rd century AD? Was that simply the culmination of a deliberate policy to destroy archaeological and literary remains that would have given us a wholly different viewpoint of what was happening around the origins of Christianity in the first 2 centuries AD?
Wow. So you're saying there's a conspiracy?
I think that there are indications, when you look at world events going back the last 2 millennia and possibly even further, that there has been some kind of conspiratorial scenario going on to keep from the general populace some idea about the truth, the historical truth of what's been going on. And, you know, people, there's so much on the internet now that's coming through, which you don't find in the mainstream media, that gives a whole different viewpoint on what's going on in the world. And, you know, you've got an alternative way of looking at things. Doesn't it seem that that's correct? But there is an alternative option to look at, and then you can make a comparison between what we're spoon-fed through the mass media and what people are more and more talking about, an alternative version of history, and use your own powers of deduction and insight to see which you think fits the historical facts as, you know, and the course of world events. This is the thing. That's what doesn't lie, is the course of world events.
Yes. So what do you think not the reason for the cover-up. We know why there may be a cover-up. What do you think is the backstory? Out of the research that you've done over the last 15 years, Barry, do you have a kind of for want of a better word, a big picture of that period of time, or of even a greater period of time around that? Has it expanded from the 2 millennia ago to something even more ancient?
Yeah, I think you're definitely right, Jeremy. There is a much bigger picture underpinning this whole thing. The general idea is to connect history as disconnected episodes. The key is to see the connections. And see, when you look at the connections, you can see there's a thread or a continuity running through history, which sometimes gives you a clearer understanding of what's been going on. So, this has always been what I've been trying to search and seek out, is what is the bigger picture, you know? Try and understand the truth about what's been going on, rather than possibly, you know, the misinformation and disinformation that's been passed down. And so that's not been easy to ferret that out, to be honest. And it's taken a good 15 years of doing an awful lot of research, looking into many, many books going back, not just, you know, the last 50 years, but going back 300-odd years. And also looking, as I said earlier, at possible clues and place names.
I think that's the most fascinating study. I was started on that by reading the book called The Old Straight Track by Alfred Watkins.
Yes, I know it, yeah.
Yes, the seminal work on ley lines and earth energies. That really opened my eyes up, and everything started to become quite plain to me when I was wandering around the streets of London and seeing all these street names and place names and the Earth Star and all these things around London. That's where I grew up, you see. And then to see it when I came to Scotland, I can see how that name gets constructed, even with a different accent.
Surely. Well, of course, you know, Hamish Miller and Paul Broadhurst, their book, The Son of the Serpent, that was another seminal work where they delved up what they felt with the Mary and Michael alignments in these ley lines down in southwest England.
Mm.
And again, they were tracking them through Michael and Mary place names.
That's right, St. Michael's Church, St. Mary's Church, all that stuff.
So on and so forth, yeah. So that's another aspect which they simply determined through following the dowsing. Now, to give you an example, perhaps, of what I'm getting at here with the place names,
mm-hmm.
one quite significant one that I found is located actually in Dundagan Bay off the northwest of the Western Isle of Skye.
Mm-hmm.
There's two small islands in Dundagan Bay, and one of them's called Eleonisa, which translates as the Island of Jesus. Now, up until about 100 years ago, on maps, that island, Eleonisa, was spelled ISA. Now, that's the Middle Eastern Arabic name for Jesus.
Yeah,
Isa. It translates as God saves, apparently. And but in more recent times, if you look at map, current maps, spell it ISAY. Now, whether they're trying to imply it's got some sort of Viking Norse connection, I don't know. But a local Scottish minister is writing in a statistical account of the Scotland of that area in, I think, the 1840s, clearly translates the island of Isa, which is spelled ISA, as the island of Jesus. Now, there's no religious dedications on that small island. There's no chapels or churches, which would suggest some kind of religious association in that respect. What we do know is that during the early centuries AD, many places that have been sanctified by holy men and women were recorded in the subsequent Gaelic place names. Because these people had been there, they sanctified the place, and their names were associated with it henceforth. For example, St. Ninian, we can track where he went to all these Kilminian sites across Scotland.
That's right.
Kil being, you know, the ancient word for cells. And so we know, and again, up around here, you can see there was a high concentration of all the leading Celtic saints were coming into this area of central Scotland, like Adamnan, Ian, as he's known in the Gaelic, from Iona, Cuthbert from Iona was in here, Aidan, another one from Iona, and so on. So their presence is recorded in the local place names in the area. So taking that into account, the implication to me is that to name an island, the small island, Dunbegan Bay, the island of Isa, the island of Jesus, suggests that Isa was on that island.
Mm.
So named, you know, in honour of the fact that he sanctified the place with his presence there. There's no other real explanation for it. Now, in the Gaelic dictionaries, if you check out Jesus in Gaelic, it's about I-O-S-A, it's pronounced Iosa.
Mm.
And what happened was Isa and Iosa, it's just a inflection in the pronunciation. So when the Gael pronounced the Middle Eastern Isa as Isa, someone went to write it down. Instead of writing it ISA, they write it IOSA.
Mm.
And significantly, in India and Tibet, Jesus is known as St. Isa.
That's right.
Either ISA or IOSA.
That's right.
So, you know, this is quite interesting. In the light of these stories of Jesus and Joseph Arimathea came to southwest Britain, could not he and possibly they have come up that western seaboard to the Western Isles of Scotland?
Quite possibly.
How else do you explain this, you know, the naming of this island of Isa, which is using the Middle Eastern spelling and not even the Gaelic spelling? And in support of that, there was a guy called Henry Jenner, who worked in the manuscripts department at the British Museum, the latter part of the 19th century, early 20th century. Now, Jenner wrote in an article that was published in the Western Morning News back in 1933. He was actually writing about the Christ in Cornwall stories,
mm-hmm.
and he came from Cornwall. But during the course of that article, he mentions that he was on South Uist, another one of the Western Isles of Scotland, and I later found out that he was there in 1895. And he said that while he was there, he found a whole set of legends, obviously oral tradition, that both Jesus and his mother Mary had visited the Western Isles of Scotland. So there was an oral tradition out there that he found.
Is there any indication whether Jesus spent the time in Scotland before the crucifixion or after the crucifixion?
Difficult to say for sure, but I think it could have even been both.
Mm-hmm.
There are indications that possibly he came both as a boy and later on in manhood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of the traditions down in the old mining quarters of Cornwall suggest that Joseph of Arimathea came as a boy with his uncle or great-uncle Joseph of Arimathea.
Mm.
And but there are also indications, you know, in the apocryphal stories that Jesus sort of did the rounds of visiting the various mystery temples around the world. You know, there are stories that he went to the mystery temples of Egypt, of Greece, India, Tibet. So therefore, he could easily have, you know, if he came to the British Isles, as some of the legends and traditions suggest, no doubt he would have visited the Druid mystery schools.
So he would.
And what's interesting in that connection is that about 4 miles as the crow flies from this island of Isa in Dunvegan Bay, there is a major pre-Christian mystery temple site called the Temple of Anitus. Now, that's just 4 miles from this island of Isa. So if Jesus is doing the rounds visiting these mystery temples, we find there's one just 4 miles away from the island of Isa.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for me, that strikes as being beyond the realms of coincidence. This was a major mystery temple. Even when they looked at it and did some archaeological investigations around it back in the 1920s, they mapped it out, and you can see it's a very extensive site, and it's just at Dunvegan.
So this is an island off an island of Uris, is that right?
Dunvegan is the Isle of Skye, which is one of the western isles of Scotland.
All right, yes, I know the Isle of Skye. I've performed there a couple of times. Yep.
And South Uist is another one of the Western Isles of Scotland.
Yes.
So here we've got these stories, we've got a place name and oral tradition linking Jesus and also apparently his mother to the Western Isles of Scotland.
Mm.
Now, in further support of that, I don't know if you've ever come across a very interesting Scottish writer called William Sharp.
No.
Now, Sharp wrote a number of interesting books under the pseudonym of Fiona MacLeod.
Oh.
And about, you know, the ancient Celtic mythos, you know, these stories were really based around the Western Isles, the Western Highlands of Scotland. And he spent a lot of time, Sharp, with the old shepherds and the fishermen and the gypsies, trying to find out a lot about the ancient folklore of those areas, Western Isles and Highlands. And as a result of that, he put a lot of it into these fictional story that he wrote under the pseudonym of Fiona MacLeod. But Sharp also wrote some non-fictional work, and he did an essay on Iona, I think published around 1900. And in that essay, he refers to an ancient prophecy that Christ will come again to Iona. Now, that presupposes that someone suggesting that he'd been on Iona before.
Well, he'd been there, yeah.
And he also mentions in his essay, coming across an oral tradition, that Mary Magdalene had been on Iona as well.
Mm.
So he's getting all this stuff from an oral tradition in this remote region, where conceivably these stories could have been passed down from hand to mouth and kept intact.
Mm.
You know, the old bards and the Senecas were very strict on memorizing these stories and also the genealogies of the various families in the area. And so it's perfectly conceivable that an oral tradition could come down quite accurately, more so than written stuff that can be interfered with.
More than an oral tradition, Barry, do you think there's any possibility, now this is just coming off the top of my head, any possibility that there could be a bloodline still there?
Well, that is conceivable. It's difficult to know after 2 millennia exactly, you know, what has survived. In terms of a bloodline or documentation or whatever, I could only work with what I've got, and that's the oral traditions, the legends, and the Gaelic placemates. These are sort of things that you could actually, you know, get to grips with and see how, you know, if you could find some kind of a picture emerging from this. And if you get enough circumstantial evidence, it tends to suggest that there's some think factual underpinning it all.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as far as the bloodline goes, there's a lot of speculation out there, I know in particular, in relation to Jesus and Mary Magdalene. Professor Hugh Montgomery, in his book, The God Kings of Europe, published a couple of years ago, does mention a son being born to Jesus and Mary Magdalene, connected and born on Iona. And this is something that I've looked at and wondered about myself.
That's kind of what I was getting at.
Yeah. So, again, it's very difficult to prove anything at this point in time because we don't have contemporaneous documents to really reinforce this. You know, it could be there is still some information extant somewhere, but it's certainly not coming to the public domain. There may be some things tucked away in the secret archives of the Vatican. Who knows?
Who knows what's in the secret archives of the Vatican? Indeed, it would be a very wonderful day when we see what's contained in that library.
Surely, yeah.
That would be a very nice thing. So, talking of the Mary, the Mother of Jesus, I see there's a heading here. Could you talk about a female apostolic succession?
Well, there again, I mean, you know, in the early Celtic Church, as distinct from the Roman Catholic Church, the women were acknowledged as much as the men. In other words, there are female saints as well as male saints. Now, when you look into the genealogies and the histories surrounding these male and female Celtic saints, you know, particularly from sort of around about 400 AD, Justinian, right through to perhaps about 700, 800 AD, that period in particular, Columba and all the rest of them, you'll find that all of them, as far as I can determine, are related to the bloodline of the old British and Irish Celtic Gaelic bloodline, both the men and the women. Now, when you look into some of, for example, if you look into some of the old Welsh records, some of these male and female Celtic saints claim that they're directly descended either from Mother Mary, Mother of Christ, or a close relative of hers.
Mm-hmm.
And again, bearing in mind that in these times, people were very conscious of their genealogies, and the Senecas and the Bards took a great deal of trouble to determine the accuracy around this. So, by these old world records, that a number of these Celtic saints, male and female, were claiming direct descent, effectively, from the holy bloodline of Christ.
Mm.
Now, what I'm wondering is that, as we know there was apparently a male apostolic succession, I've often wondered, was there a female apostolic succession? And if it was, it was very likely it was based on a hereditary basis of succession. In other words, it came from the family. And probably it was the same with the male apostolic church. You know, if it came through, for example, James, the brother of Jesus, from what's called the Jerusalem church. And also there were relatives of Jude that were tied in apparently to all that as well, and he was apparently another brother of Christ. So it looks to me as if the true descent of the apostolic succession, to some extent at any rate, came through relatives or descendants of the Holy Family of Christ. Now, if these male and female early Celtic saints were claiming to be tied into that bloodline, then they could have represented an apostolic succession in Celtic Britain. And that could have included these female saints as well as the male saints, because they all came out of the old British Gaelic royal lineages.
Mm. That's fascinating. That's absolutely fascinating. So, do you think that our data gap from 0 to 300 BC is in some way an attempt to disguise or hide the female, the divine feminine? Because that does seem to be having a resurgence just now.
Yeah, I think that was probably one of the things that was suppressed, for sure. The other thing that was repressed was probably what the real teaching of Christ was all about, which was nothing to do with church and priesthood.
Absolutely.
The essence of it was that the kingdom of God was within you.
Yes.
It was all about spiritual sovereignty of the individual.
Absolutely. That's the word that I was just going to suggest, is sovereignty, which again is getting quite a good revival just now.
Yeah. You know, you don't need to go through a church or a priest to connect with the divine nature that's within everybody.
Yeah.
And that was the essential message, I think, of the Christ teaching. And that was very much connected with the esoteric teaching of St. John, there were really two streamings from the early Christianity. One was the esoteric, which was the mystery teaching of John. The other was the exoteric, the outer teaching, which came through Peter, the Petrine teaching. And that was subsequently hijacked by, you know, the centralized patriarchal and hierarchical Roman Church, which has now been centered in the Vatican.
Yeah.
And that was the exoteric or outer teaching. But the esoteric or inner teaching was the teaching attributed to the mystery teaching of John. The essence of the Christ message is found in the fourth gospel of John, which somehow seems to escape all the censorship that went on. If one really looks into that, you can find what the essence of the Christ teaching is all about. And interestingly, Celtic spirituality and the cult monastic church centered on the teaching of John rather than the Petrine teaching.
Mm.
And that John is really, again, that is the central corpus, really, of what became known as the Grail Romances in the Middle Ages. So, which again was tied back into Celtic Britain.
So presumably that's where the Templars, so is there a connection? I'll rewind that. Is there a connection with the Templars in this respect, that they were trying to uncover some truth that had been hidden?
Yeah, I think the thing to do is to try and see what the continuity of all this was.
Yeah.
And just to give a brief overview of how it came to, you know, how I perceived it based on my research, was that when Joseph Arimathea and these other seen missions came out from the Middle East, they connected with the pre-existing Druid Magi in the British Isles. Now, the Druids never had a problem with this Christ message at all. There was never any friction, any conflict. In fact, what happened was it seems as if the Druids readily absorbed this Middle Eastern ascetic tradition, and out of that evolved the early Celtic monastic church, which was known as the Chaldees. And the Chaldees claimed that their teaching was based on the teaching of the disciples of St. John. And so here we had this early Celtic spirituality, the Celtic Chaldee monastic church, really evolved out of a fusion between the Middle Eastern Essenes and the pre-Christian Druid Magi. Now, what we see was, at that point in the early centuries AD, the Chaldee monastic church was making strong headway throughout the whole of Western Europe. Chaldee monastic sites were being established in areas that we now call France and Switzerland and Germany, quite extensive sites. And to a point where the Vatican, the Church of Rome, was starting to get worried. So they then sent out their missions to try and undermine all this. In fact, in around 600 AD, they sent an Augustinian mission in here. Now, subsequently, these Roman Catholic missions came into the ascendancy. And as they came to the forefront more and more, through whatever means that was used at the time, the earlier Celtic Chaldee monastic church was suppressed more and more until it finally died out in the Middle Ages. But what's interesting is with the demise of the Chaldee tradition, we see it concurrent with that, the rise of the Templar tradition. Now, the Templars were both priests and warrior. They were warrior monks.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a religious side to the Templars as well as the warrior military side.
Mm.
And I think that the religious side was very much a consequence of the tradition, because the Templars, again, were based on their patron was St. John. And so they were very much connected into the Johannine message, the Johannine teaching. So I think what happened was that the Templars somehow, and to some extent I think the Cathars in France, which also had a link with the Templars, were a continuity of this earlier Chaldee Johannine spiritual teaching.
Right, and so then that brings them directly into conflict with the Catholics.
Yeah, I think there was. And, of course, this is why you can see the Chaldee Church was suppressed by the later Catholic monasteries, you know, the Augustinian, the Benedictine, the Augustinians, and so on. They came to the forefront with the demise of the old Chaldee fraternities.
Mm.
And also, of course, later on they suppressed the Templars. So first we had the Cathars suppressed, then the Templars, and, of course, then the Cathars were suppressed.
Mm.
So, you know, what was it that was coming through? You see, what it was the esoteric Johannine teaching, which was really tied in to the Christ message, the core teaching of Christ.
The absolute message. Yes.
They were trying to suppress the orders and fraternities that were actually trying to bring forth that true Christ message.
Okay, so do you want to outline that message? And also contrast it with what has eventually become world Christianity, which is the Catholic message. Would you like to contrast that for us?
Well, essentially, I think, you know, world Christianity or religious Christianity is very much a centralized churchianity.
Mm-hmm.
It's all under a centralized sort of hierarchy, which is patriarchal, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas the original Christ message was teaching the sanctity of individual and personal spiritual sovereignty and the personal responsibility, of course, that goes with that. You know, you didn't need to go through a priest or say or a church to connect with the divine within you. This was the essence, I think, of the early Celtic church. Celtic spirituality is much more bound back to the individual, whereas the religious churchianity is much more bound back into the group consciousness.
Mm.
So I think, you know, you're looking at centralized control and group consciousness as opposed to decentralized influence and, you know, often coming right back to the individual. You know, that the kingdom of God is within you and that I am the way, the truth, and the life. It's each individual, you see.
Yes, I am being everybody's I am.
Exactly. Yeah, he didn't say Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life.
Mm.
He said that I am the way, the truth, and the life.
Mm.
And that was the I am state of consciousness, you know.
Yes.
It's, you know, the soul realization within each individual.
Mm. Great, thank you. So, moving back to... Scotland here, and I don't know if you've seen anything. While I was researching your stuff, I came across some other information about the land where I live. I live in Moray, which is a strange place because, first of all, it's not a shire. It's not Moray Shire, although they tried to call it that. It's called Moray. And then I was reading last night, it says Moray is known as the land of the giants. Do you know anything about that?
Well, you know, people have talked about the ancient myths of the British Isles and elsewhere, of course, around the planet, relating to these giants. Some people think it ties back to the ancient continent of Atlantis.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently they've even found quite large skeletons of what appear to be giant people in the past. But certainly there are stories about giants. I mean, where we are here in central Perth, you know, right at the centre we've got the mountain Schiehallion, which translates as the fairy hill of the Caledonian. And on the southwest flank of Schiehallion, there's a cave known as the Giant's Cave. The story being that they found the remains of a giant there many years ago. So, you know, this whole... mythos around giants is not uncommon, both I think in the British Isles and other parts of the world.
Mm. There was a big bit of disinformation that got put out about that because there was a competition apparently for people to play with the program Photoshop to see if they could simulate pictures of giant skeletons being discovered, and so there's a large group of pictures that were actually faked. As part of an art exercise, as it were.
One thing I didn't want to bring in while I think of it was I touched on the possible connection with ancient Egypt. I talked about Joseph Arimathea and these Essene groups possibly coming to the British Isles.
Mm.
And the Essenes apparently came out of the ancient mystery teaching in Egypt. They were in Egypt as much as Palestine.
Mm.
And there is a... possible indications of connections between ancient Scotland and ancient Egypt. For example, there's a story about Princess Scota coming from Egypt, apparently, to, I think it was Spain, and then her descendants going to Ireland and then eventually coming here. And that Scotland and the Scots actually derives from Princess Scota, who was an ancient Egyptian princess. The other thing to point out was this temple of Anaitis that I referred to earlier. Anaitis was the mother goddess, the leading mother goddess in the Middle East, in Egypt, Palestine, Armenia, that whole area. And so here we find she was being worshipped in the Western Isles of Scotland and also the Highlands of Scotland. So there's interesting connections, I think, tied in, possibly with ancient Egypt and this worship of Anaitis.
So how do you spell that?
Well, Anaitis is spelled A-N-A-I-T-I-S.
Right.
Now, if you look on maps today, you will find there are Anak plates names on the map. A-N-N-A-T, or sometimes it's A-N-N-E-T, something like that. These Anak place names were originally sites that were dedicated to the worship of Anaitis, this mother goddess from the Middle East. And these sites almost always seem to be associated with water nearby. And I have a feeling that she was connected with lunar worship of the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And now in the ancient mythos, particularly the Phoenician mythos, Anaitis was the sister of Bel or Baal. Of course, we know about the Beltane fire worship, lighting of the Beltane fires. So that was in dedication to Bel or Baal, her brother, and this was the solar worship. And she, I suspect, was being acknowledged in relation to lunar worship.
That makes sense.
So this whole mode of worship from the Middle East was being carried on by the Celtic Gael. Through these Anat place names. Now, the other interesting thing is that these Anat sites were also referred to by the early Celtic monks as the Mother Church. There's a place in far reaches of Glen Ryan called Achnahanet, which translates as the field of the Mother Church. So they were identifying this as the Mother Church. So it's almost like the original Christian Gnosis, that Christian Gnostic Christianity, evolved out of this Mother Church, this pre-Christian mystery temple tradition.
Mm.
So there's some interesting links about that, which I go into more in my book.
So do you think the data gap, if we can call it that, was an attempt to create an exoteric spirituality or religion? Well, let's say a religion as a control mechanism that was so loosely based on the truth, the true tradition, but that it was twisted to be control. That's a kind of, in a way, that's a very obvious answer. But do you think that the data gap was created by the powers that be, as we still call them?
I think so. I think, yes, I do think that. I think that was deliberately taken out of circulation, what was going on then. And so onto the original Christ teaching, they grafted a kind of a bastard theological tradition, based, as I say, on this centralized, monopolistic, hierarchical and patriarchal control system, where you had to go through the priest and the church to connect with God.
Very much like the Roman regime, where
you had your
centurions and your different hierarchies.
So yeah, sure.
The hierarchy of the Roman Empire.
Sure. So, you know, it's curious to me that this crucial period of the first century AD is where we find a complete dearth of both archaeological and literary remains that would clarify for us what was really happening around the origins of what we call Christianity.
Mm. And do you think some of those remains were not destroyed, but, for instance, taken back to the Vatican Library?
That's certainly a possibility. There may even be some contemporary Roman artifacts that are buried in a museum somewhere. No one is aware of the significance of what's on them.
Mm.
Because the thing about, the Romans were here during the 1st and 2nd century AD. They were leaving inscribed stones with Latin inscriptions on them. And some of them could have given us some kind of indication as to what was really happening. There's just an outside chance that there might be one or two tucked away in the basement of some museum and no one's recognised the significance of what's on those inscriptions.
Mm.
at the same time, I have a feeling that the majority of it, if not almost all of it, has been taken out of circulation, so we don't know what might have been on those inscriptions of that period.
Yeah, it kind of it kind of reflects all the like the current modern sort of ET cover up that goes on. You know, you get somebody who says, "Oh, I saw a flying saucer fly over the mountain there," and suddenly the whole hillside is cordoned off and it's scrubbed clean of any artifacts.
Sure. So it sounds like a reflection of that. Yeah. These sort of things happened at Roswell in New Mexico.
Exactly.
The people was cordoned off and people were shutting up and finding out what was really going on there.
Exactly.
With, you know, the alleged UFO crash at Roswell back in
1970
in New Mexico. So, yeah, I mean, this is just standard procedure by the so-called powers that be.
Yeah. So, back to the caves. I mean, one of the things that really fascinated me about when I came across your stuff again was the connection with the caves that led somewhere.
Well, there are stories that these cavernous entities actually, you know, connect up with tunnels and chambers and possibly even it's even been alleged cities that are underground.
Mm.
Again, this whole mythos is to be found in almost all the ancient tribal and racial traditions. And so, this, you know, which suggests there's got to be something underpinning all this.
Yes.
In the Buddhist tradition, they talk about the underground Kinragati,
mm-hmm.
which is supposedly a city somewhere under Tibet.
Yes.
And then there's been stories about underground cities or places, some kind of subterranean domain under, for example, the Gobi Desert in Mongolia. Stories are told about underground subterranean activities underneath Mount Shasta.
Yes.
And similar stories have been told about Shehallion here in Scotland, that there are underground passages and chambers, and stories about doors that open and close by themselves. Similar stories are told about the Himalayas as well.
Mm.
So you think, well, you know, there's got to be something that's given rise to all of this.
Definitely. And so have you done any personal exploration of these caves?
I haven't done so myself, no. No. They're usually in remote mountainous regions,
mm.
and not easy to access.
Mm.
So finding them is the first step. You know, there is this, what we call the Hollow Earth theory.
Yes.
In fact, there was a book written, I think, back in 1998 by a South African, Jan Lamprecht, called Hollow Planets, where he's suggesting that there may be a common sort of principle throughout the universe that, where all the planets are hollow.
Certainly.
And he backs it up with some quite interesting scientific evidence.
Well, there's certainly a very compelling video on YouTube, which is called The Expanding Earth Theory, which was actually done by a cartoonist called Neil Adams. I think he was like a Spider-Man cartoonist or something like that. And he took the relationship from naval soundings all over the world of the depths and the age of the sediment at the bottom of the oceans. And the navies sampled the whole world, and there are commonly available maps showing the age of the different parts of the ocean. And if you were to peel those parts out and kind of glue them back, you would go back in time, and what you find is that the planet actually gets smaller. The idea of tectonic plates and subduction and transduction and all this stuff is actually another one of those scientific conspiracies in order to disguise the fact that the planet actually has grown in the last 65 million years about twice its size. Have you come across that theory?
I haven't actually, but it certainly sounds intriguing.
What they find is that, you know, all the continents fit together perfectly. So it begs the question, okay, so if I take a small balloon, blow it up so it's a circle, dip it in some paint, allow the paint to dry, and then blow the balloon up further, What does it do? It forms what looks like continents.
Yeah. Well, I know what I did find was that NASA had taken some photographs over the North Pole back in the 1960s.
Mm.
And it should clearly, which is normally covered with clouds, but on this occasion it wasn't. And you can see there's a distinct, quite an extensive circular opening at the pole, at the top of the planet, so to speak, the northern hemisphere of the planet, what we take to the North Pole, there's a huge circular opening.
Mm.
And that kind of fits in with these strange journeys that Rear Admiral Laird took back in the 1950s, mission to the North Pole.
I'm sorry, Barry, you got broken up there.
Sorry.
Start again, Dan.
Am I back on again?
Yeah, you're back on. You got broken up there.
So I was talking about Rear Admiral Richard Byrd.
Richard Byrd, yes.
Went on a secretive flying mission back in 1947, where he flew to the North Pole. And they subsequently said that he'd flown some 2,000 miles into it. How do you account for that? And then in the mid-50s, they took another secretive flying mission to the South Pole, where again, it came out that they claimed that they'd flown some 2,000 miles into the South Pole. So are there these huge polar entrances which are being shown up on the NASA satellite photos, which were being investigated by Byrd's secretive flying missions back in the 40s and 50s? You know, what is all that fed into?
And is there somebody sitting in the back office in NASA painting over all the satellite pictures?
Well, this is it. How come whenever they get these probes going to Mars, just as it gets interesting, the pictures already fade out, you know? And it was a problem getting the pictures back. There's a few to a general one to let out. But so often, I'd notice that these probes get some weird things of what might be on Mars.
Mm.
The cameras suddenly go offline.
Very strange, isn't it? Very convenient, very strange. You know, they spend all these millions and then they don't seem to care too much about it.
Hello?
Hi, we probably seem to be receiving a bit of interference here. Either that or my housemate is downloading some YouTube.
Right.
Because I'm on Skype and you're on the landline, so it shouldn't be any problem with that. Wow. So, where do we go from here? If we know all this stuff, how does that change our world?
Well, I think people have definitely got to perhaps find a way of learning things. I think William Blake was touching into something, you know, this amazing English visionary poet, mystic, who of course, you know, in those famous lines, records and did those walk upon England's mountains green.
Yes.
And I'm suggesting Scotland as well. Now, Blake had claimed that he was under the direction of messengers from heaven. So what was he actually picking up on? What was he intuitively wondering about in relation to ancient Albion, which was the most ancient name for the British Isles? Now, interestingly, the most ancient name for Scotland is Alban, A-L-B-A-N.
Yes.
And the people known as the Alban. They're the people of Alban. And even this area where we live in central Scotland, even now, is called Bred Alban, from Braid Alban, the higher regions of Alban.
Right.
And so Alban and Albion obviously comes from the same etymological roots.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Blake, in one of his lines, I hadn't realised this until after I came up with my title, Vision of Albion, for the last book. I found that in one of the lines in his poems is actually, "O behold, the vision of Albion."
All right.
So Blake saw Albion as the archetypal Holy Land. He didn't believe or see it as being out in the Middle East. He saw it as being the British Isles or ancient Albion, the archetypal Holy Land. And I touch on this in my most recent book with other information. But coming back to the fact that the old Scots name for Scotland was Auburn, when we look at Welsh Gaelic dictionaries, we find that Auburn translates as cardinal point. So why was this area seen by the ancient geomancers as the cardinal point? Could it relate to what was seen in the old mythos by the shamans as the world axis? The point on the key node on the planet where the terrestrial energies coming from on high, so to speak, were coming through the planet and into the subterrestrial energies of the planet. There's a key node on the planet that they identify as the world axis, the point at which everything revolved around. And if this was known as the cardinal point, was that the center point from which the four cardinal points, north, east, south, and west, radiated out from?
Mm.
Was there a key node on the planet which the ancient shaman geomancers had determined was the world axis, the key node on the planet? Everything revolves around it. Why would they call this area Auburn, the cardinal point? Now, in the old tradition, the world axis was identified by a conical world mountain and a world tree. Now, John Michell, who's written a lot of books about the ley lines and the ancient energies of Britain and so on, who's really an authority on it, he tells us that in the ancient mythos, the world mountain was always sighted due north of the world tree. Well, what we find is that for Schiehallion, which is a conical mountain, is sighted 5 miles due north of the famous yew tree at Fortingall, which is believed to be the oldest living vegetation in Europe. So what I'm wondering is, you know, why was that yew tree there? Why is it still thriving as it is today after 5,000 years? The conical mountain Schiehallion, Fairy Hill of Caledonia, is sighted due north of it. So the correlation between the ancient yew and the conical mountain Schiehallion entirely fits the mythos that's been written about by John Michell in relation to the world axis. Does that tree and that mountain, is that the archetypal world tree and the archetypal world mountain, and the correlation between the two suggesting that that is the world axis? And that, of course, both those places come within the place named Auburn, the cardinal point.
Cardinal point, how interesting.
Yeah.
And
so that's what I deal with in other chapters in my most recent book, Vision of Albion.
Hmm.
So if you know, if that is so, then you know, a lot of these this is why, you know, I talk about the sacred history of the British Isles, you know, the fact that William Blake was picking up on something really important. The fact that, you know, all the energy systems, the ley lines, and various sites, megalithic sites, all seem to line up within the British Isles are so significant. And then, of course, they in turn may relate to other major sacred sites around the planet.
Mm.
I mean, I forgot the guy's name, but there was one person that did who looked at some of the correlation between some of the ancient sites. And he found a direct link between the megalithic stone complex at Calnish on the Isle of Lewis in Western Isles of Scotland and the Giza complex at Cairo in Egypt.
Yes.
He's finding a depth. And other people have been doing research into how these PowerPoints, so to speak, may actually link up on a world grid system.
Mm. Yeah, I've been doing a bit of investigation on that myself. I can't remember who did it and what his name is. But you know that there is a dodecahedral, geometric matrix that connects various points, various power points on the Earth. And one of those points turns out to be in Western Sutherland, near the west coast of Scotland, up these points that you're talking about. And that line runs right through Cawdor Castle, which is sort of about 17 miles from here. And Cawdor Castle is, of course, the same Cawdor as in the Shakespearean Macbeth plays.
I don't doubt that, you know, it's amazing. You look up where these places have been built, whether it's castles, churches, or so on, temples and so on, they invariably seem to be on these note that aligned with each other.
Yes.
So, and more and more research has been done in the last decade or so, and there's, it's a study in itself. And I'm sure more and more information will be forthcoming in the near future around all of this.
Mm. So, Barry, thank you for a most interesting conversation.
That's a pleasure.
And good luck with your book sales. Would you like to tell the audience a few of your websites where people can buy your book?
Well, surely. Our website is called Sacred Connections, with an S, .co.uk, that's sacredconnections.co.uk. We've got a lot of articles up there that you can have a look at. My most recent book, Vision of Albion, that can be purchased through the website. I've also got a DVD of a 90-minute PowerPoint presentation I did at a conference last year. That's available. And so another information on the website as well. People are certainly welcome to have a look at that.
Yeah, and there's some lovely photos and some beautiful images of our lovely country here.
Yeah, we tried to put some nice visuals on there as well.
Yeah, so I mean, when you're talking about Scotland, you really have to show it to people, because most people think it's a sort of a frozen land of cold wind and thistles, which actually most of the time it is. But when the wind stops blowing and it stops raining, then it is just a piece of heaven.
It is. I mean, you know, when you see it in the summer with all the flowers out and the hills and so on, I mean, I don't think there's anywhere in the world that will touch it. And in fact, even at any time of the year, you know, it has its own special aura. And that's what kept drawing me back, you know. I mean, just the mystique and the aura of this particular part of central Scotland, and really Scotland in general. And it does have its own special magical qualities, which I think more and more people are realising when they come here. I do local guided tours around some of the sites in this area related to my historical research.
Mm.
And I get groups coming from all over the world. And they really do connect with the energy of this area and other parts of Scotland.
Do you ever come up north?
Sorry?
Do you ever come up north to Murray?
I haven't been for a while, no. Mm. It's been a while since I've been up north, but I will try and get up there.
Mm-hmm. I live near Findhorn.
Oh, yeah, I have been up to around Findhorn. I've got some friends who live somewhere around there, around Forres, and I've got other friends on the Black Isle.
Yeah. That's more stories. Barry Dunford, thank you very much. It's been a fascinating conversation this afternoon, and I'm sure our audience has had an equally fascinating listen to it.
Thank you for inviting me, Gary.
You're very, very welcome. And tonight we're talking with Barry Dunford, who is...
No, it's on automatic repeat. I'm going to take that off. Try to play the whole thing again. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. It's been a wonderful session with Barry this evening. And Barry's website is sacredconnections.co.uk. That's sacredconnections.co.uk. And it's got some lovely pictures of Scotland here. And so enjoy those pictures, enjoy his website, and enjoy the Becca Hargan's grid, which is the Earth grid node point, which occurs very close to here. Thank you very much once again, and I will speak to you next week. Actually, if anybody's still on Blog Talk Radio, in a few hours' time, I will be on PIG Radio, Project Information Generation Radio, and I will be speaking with Laura Eisenhower. She is the great-granddaughter of General Eisenhower of the American presidency fame. Next week, we hopefully will have Eliyahu Priest, a light worker from Edinburgh, and he'll have some very interesting things to say. And so, with that, good night.